and more with every additional exposure. In response, researchers have two explanations. The first is that the experiment might have been lacking enough exposures to trigger the boredom effect that we see in the downward slope of the creative curve. The second and more likely explanation is that researchers believe that how you and I process a concept is vital to how we learn to like or dislike it. For example, in the Canadian music study mentioned earlier, it turned out that the bell curve happened only when students were asked to listen to the music intently. If the music was played faintly in the background, the students often kept on liking the song more and more as they heard it over and over again, with no apparent end. So, why is this? It turns out that when we consume something superficially, whether it's an advertisement, song, or work of art, our brains process it in a different way than they do when we consume something in depth or over time. A process that neuroscientists call perceptual fluency takes hold. It works like this. The first time we see or experience something, our brains have to work hard to process it. However, if we've already experienced that thing, we are naturally more fluent in it, and our brains can process it more efficiently. The thing is, typically, we tend to confuse this ease of processing with actual liking. When you think about it, it's a lot easier for us to process a song we've heard overhead in the supermarket or drugstore 100 or so times. Along the way, we tend to mistake ease with actual enjoyment. Advertising researcher Christine Nordholm has studied this effect in advertising. She found that if a print ad repeatedly displayed a small or superficial feature, a background, say, or a logo, people reported liking the product in question more every time they saw it. This is why marketers deem logos and brand colors as essential to creating and maintaining consumer goodwill. The little things make it a lot easier for our brains to process the advertisements we see every day. And the ease of mental processing often gets mistaken for actually liking that toothpaste, aftershave, or insurance company. In contrast, Nordholm found that if she asked respondents to examine the same ads carefully, the creative curve kicked in. After viewing an advertisement 10 times, the participants reported liking the underlying products less and less with each viewing. When you process things deeply, you take time to evaluate them, and your competing emotions involving familiarity and novelty come into play. Deep processing takes place either because you're intentionally paying close attention to something, or because the object or concept is inherently complex and requires more than normal processing. For example, abstract art demands significant mental processing by its audience because of its multifaceted nature. There is both explicit and implicit meaning, and is therefore subject to the creative curve. But the creative curve isn't just an academic tool. It provides a practical framework for navigating the tension between the pursuit of both the familiar and the novel. Put simply, it is the very real foundation of mainstream success. The question remains, how do some creative people achieve consistent success at creating ideas in the sweet spot? How are they able to come up with one idea after another that sits to the left of the pointed cliche with optimal odds of becoming a hit? To answer this, let's go back to Paul McCartney and the Beatles. The math behind the Beatles. It was 1965, and Beatlemania was in full bloom. And while McCartney toiled to finish Yesterday, the other Beatles were seeking ways to grow artistically while under a burdensome microscope of global fame. George Harrison thought he had found an outlet on the set of their film Help. The movie's plot pokes fun at the idea of an Eastern cult that was vaguely Indian. It was in this setting that George Harrison made a discovery that changed pop music. In one scene, which takes place in an overdone Indian restaurant, A group of musicians began serenading the diners using traditional Far Eastern instruments. At one point during production, Harrison picked up one of the prop instruments. It was a sitar, a 12-stringed instrument that resembles the guitar. The sitar was well known across India, but completely new to Harrison. Ironically, at the same time that the Beatles were making fun of Indian culture and help, Harrison became intrigued by the mesmerizing twang and sheer foreignness of the sitar. Seeking as ever to build his own identity within the group and continue to grow artistically, Harrison came to the conclusion that the sitar could bring about some much-needed change for himself, both musically and personally. Back in London, he bought his first ever sitar at Indiacraft on Oxford Street. That October, the Beatles got stuck completing a new song called Norwegian Wood for an album they planned on calling Rubber Soul. Finally, they thought to try out Harrison's new sitar. The melody clicked. Today, Norwegian Wood is remembered as the first mainstream Western song to feature a sitar, but not the last. As the song gained in popularity, the sitar began popping up elsewhere. In 1966, the Rolling Stones used it in their hit song, Paint It Black, solidifying the instrument's new role in rock music. By 1967, the quote, sitar craze was sweeping pop music. Dane Electro went so far as to release an electric version, known as the Choral Electric Sitar. This version of the sitar was accessible to many musicians. It was strung like a guitar, but had the recognizable twang of an actual sitar. The trend kept going, and more pop musicians began incorporating the instrument, ranging from Elvis Presley to the Mamas and the Papas. That same year, Harrison met Ravi Shankar, one of the godfathers of Indian music and a master of the sitar, who eventually agreed to teach Harrison how to play the instrument. Shankar, on tour in 1967, during the sitar craze, told an interviewer that the sitar, quote, is now the in thing, all of which he credited to the Beatles and Harrison's abrupt obsession with a movie prop. He said, many people, especially young people, have started listening to sitar since George Harrison, one of the Beatles, became my disciple. The Beatles had lit the match, but the ensuing fire consumed musicians everywhere. As it threatened to burn higher and higher, the Beatles began cutting back on the sitar. It ended up just being one of many new sounds the band used during their more experimental years. The sitar craze is a powerful example of the calculus behind the creative curve. Any Beatles fan knows that there were distinct phases to their musical career. Many Beatles historians will classify them into three eras: the early years, which were dominated by a pop sound, the experimental years, when their music became more psychedelic and sonically oriented, and the later years, which represented a return to the pop basics. Professor Tuomas Irola at Durham University researches empirical musicology. Put simply, he studies the quantitative characteristics of music, such as how many beats a song contains or the frequency of note repetition. In the late 1990s, he set out to understand whether the Beatles' phases were truly distinct. Did the phases in their music suddenly stop and start? Or were the shifts gradual, slowly evolving between albums? To study this, he examined, among other things, the Beatles' use of tone repetition, descending bass lines, and exotic instruments like the sitar. He then measured the use of these features in every Beatles song ever recorded. What he found was that the Beatles used these experimental features with an increasing and then decreasing frequency. When Irola created a chart showing this change over time, you can probably guess by now what shape he saw: a bell-shaped curve distribution. The Beatles' usage of experimental song features matched the creative curve. The band slowly introduced an increasing number of experimental approaches and sounds in their music as their audience grew to like them, then stopped using them as their audience risked becoming overexposed to these sounds. Part of the Beatles' creative genius was their ability to write songs that mirrored how their audience built new musical taste, which follows the creative curve. The band wrote and released songs that were familiar yet just novel enough to expose their audience to new concepts that listeners would slowly learn to like. Then, once these elements reached the point of cliché, the Beatles sharply curtailed their use. Imagine what would have happened if, instead of reducing these musical features once they reached cliché, the Beatles had continued. Their fans would have begun to get bored and might have drifted away to other bands. In the worst case scenario, the Beatles might have become a cliché themselves. The creative curve provides the framework to explain how the Beatles could bring new ideas to the market and find success, without carrying those ideas too far or staying with them too long. This has critical implications for any type of creator. For example, one way to slow down the effects of the curve is to slow down exposure. That is why many luxury brands focus on exclusivity, maximizing price to grow revenues rather than distribution. The only other way to avoid the curve is to make your product addictive. Think of the staying power of coffee or certain video games. Yet, how did the Beatles know how much sitar to use in their music? Alternatively, how did Mark Zuckerberg know which features to take away from the earliest versions of Facebook? Here is where my interviews became critical. I sat down with dozens of successful creatives from numerous fields. My goal was to understand how they managed to generate one idea after another at the sweet spot of the creative curve. Since we all have creative potential and extreme IQ genius is not a requirement for creating hits, I want to map out these individuals' creative process. What were they doing that the rest of us should consider replicating? I asked these people questions about their childhoods, how they conceived of new ideas, how they turned those ideas into reality, and how they promoted them once they were done. I often felt like a shrink, especially since I conducted a lot of interviews on couches. People invited me into their homes, their offices, and their favorite restaurants. When we couldn't meet in person, we would chat over the phone or Skype. In the end, it turned out that many of the stories I heard were similar. Ultimately, I discovered four patterns that creators use to come up with ideas that are optimized for commercial success. These methods were also supported by a variety of sciences, ranging from psychology to sociology to neuroscience. I call these the four laws of the creative curve. Over the next four chapters, I'll break down each one and explain how we can apply all of them to our own work. We'll start by discussing how to identify great ideas. And, as you will soon see, it all begins with a trip to Arizona. Part 2, The Four Laws of the Creative Curve. Chapter 7, Law 1, Consumption. It was 1982, and Arizona Video Cassettes West was packed with customers. The checkout line snaked back past the comedy section, through horror, and into international. The store was one of the first video rental stores in Arizona, but that wasn't why customers were willing to wait in line for 20 minutes or longer. If you had asked the men and women why they were standing there, their reply would have sounded nonsensical. They were all waiting in line to talk to the clerk, Ted. More to the point, many of them spent all that afternoon thinking about what question they would ask him. Why? Ted was an 18-year-old community college student. To earn extra money, he worked at Arizona Video Cassettes West, stocking shelves and checking out rentals. Ted's childhood was chaotic. His parents were just teenagers when his mother had him, and before long, he had four additional siblings running around their small house in the Phoenix suburbs. To escape the disorder at home, Ted took to visiting his grandmother's house, where he would watch endless hours of television. Ted's grandmother loved show business, which was reflected in the piles of entertainment magazines overflowing on every surface and piece of furniture. She enchanted Ted with stories about the actors of the day, referring to them by their first names as if recalling old flames. For Ted, movies and television became the ultimate escape from his own chaotic household. Not only was Ted's household in perpetual disarray, but so were the family's finances. His parents loved to spend money they didn't have, and any earnings his parents brought home were quickly spent on new gadgets and electronics. Though the landline would be disconnected from time to time because of unpaid bills, Ted's was one of the few families in the neighborhood to already own a VCR. One day, when Ted was biking around town, he noticed a new shop in one of the local strip malls, a video rental store. Thanks to the VCR his parents owned and the time he spent with his grandmother, Ted had grown up loving movies, so the new video rental store was a fantasy come true. Ted went inside and started chatting with the store owner, Dale Mason, who was behind the counter wearing a tracksuit. This was the 1980s, after all. Ted soon learned the man's life story. Dale had been an air traffic controller in Chicago before deciding to become an entrepreneur. He had read a magazine article that predicted that yogurt shops and video stores would be the biggest businesses of the decade. He told Ted, "I hate yogurt and love movies," and his path was set. Dale soon moved to Arizona, where he was able to afford both a house and a small retail space. Over the next few days, Ted returned to the video store, spending hour after hour in conversation with Dale. The two of them talked about movies as Ted made his way around the store, organizing the shelves for fun. It was clear Ted felt completely at home amid hundreds of videos, and it took Dale no time at all to realize he had found a kindred spirit. He offered Ted a job as a clerk, and Ted accepted, happy to be surrounded by VHS tapes. Most video rental stores were empty during the day. Customers typically rented movies after coming home from work. Rather than doing his homework during his quiet shifts, Ted made a pact with himself that he would watch every single movie in the store. He wanted to learn everything he possibly could about films, and finally he had the best possible resource, a well-stocked video store, at his disposal. A few months later, after watching nearly every movie on the store shelves, Ted had morphed into a human recommendation engine. If you were a customer who liked Woody Allen films, Ted would suggest you try the movies of Albert Brooks, announcing that what Woody Allen is to New York, Albert Brooks is to L.A. Like a particular action movie? Ted had three other movie suggestions that would keep your blood flowing in just the same way. Ted, in short, had developed cultural awareness, a real-time consciousness of what is familiar, what is good, and what is cliché. It is this skill that allows someone to identify where exactly an idea or product falls on the creative curve. By going on a consumption binge, Ted, at age 18, had become a movie expert, a film sommelier, in other words. He understood what made people tick, and customers, aware of his insight about what to watch and wanting to benefit from his perspective, were willing to wait and wait to talk to him. Similar to the restaurant critic whom diners trust to point out the best new places to eat, individuals with this type of awareness are valued in society. We seek them out. We refer to them as tastemakers and influencers. We even promote them to leaders in companies and in our culture. Cultural awareness, being able to identify where an idea falls in the creative curve, may appear to be out of most people's reach. While the food critic, the hip artist, and the successful mobile app founder all understand consumers, it's hard to imagine how the rest of us could gain that same skill. The thing is, we can. In this chapter, we'll explore how and why consumption can enable you to learn this skill, and we'll learn how this can also be used to purposefully increase the number of aha moments you have. Is it luck? Some entrepreneurs appear exceedingly lucky, especially the ones who create multiple successful businesses, sometimes even across multiple industries. Entrepreneur Kevin Ryan, for one, founded 9 internet companies, including the media company Business Insider, acquired for $450 million, online fashion powerhouse Gilt, acquired for $250 million, and database technology company MongoDB, valued at over $1.5 billion. Not only that, but he was part of the early team and served as CEO of the advertising technology pioneer DoubleClick, which was eventually acquired for over $1 billion. From e-commerce to media to database technology, Kevin Ryan is a serial entrepreneur with a shockingly good hit rate. Another successful serial entrepreneur is Martin Rothblatt. As a young lawyer, Rothblatt became fascinated with satellites and co-founded Sirius Radio. Today, in the wake of its merger with XM Radio, SiriusXM is valued at over $25 billion. Yet, when her daughter was diagnosed with pulmonary hypertension, a lethal and incurable disease that affects the lungs, Rothblatt left Sirius Radio and decided to reinvent herself. After taking courses in biology, she founded United Therapeutics, a biotech startup devoted to creating treatments for pulmonary hypertension and other similar lung diseases. Today, United Therapeutics is a public company valued at over $5 billion. Whereas most people would struggle to create even one great business, Ryan and Rothblatt have created multiple runaway successes. More impressive still, they were able to switch industries along the way while still achieving extraordinary success. Was it merely genetic luck, or could there be something else at work? Professor Robert Barron, who studies the intersection of entrepreneurship and psychology, wanted to understand how entrepreneurs ferret out opportunities. The answer he found is pattern recognition. One of our brain's fundamental tasks is identifying patterns. This task is critical in helping both to protect us and to discover rewarding opportunities. As we discussed, if something poses a threat to us, we want to avoid it. If something promises a potential reward, we want to explore it. Pattern recognition relies on two mental models, both of which Professor Barron believes are used by entrepreneurs to come up with new ideas. The first is a prototype, but not the kind of prototype that might immediately come up in most people's minds. In psychology, a prototype is an abstraction of any concept's fundamental properties. Think of a coffee shop. A prototype, in this case, would be a small storefront that sells coffee and muffins, has tables, and, depending on how benevolent the owners are, offers free Wi-Fi. Or, in a business context, a prototype of a tech startup would be a young, high-growth rate company that raises venture capital and offers, it believes, some sort of unique technology. Early on in their careers, entrepreneurs rely heavily on prototypes to guide their decisions. They often absorb these prototypes from books and from the advice of colleagues. For example, let's say an inexperienced entrepreneur, Mike, is interviewing a job applicant, Tom. Mike would probably use a successful employee prototype, someone who is resourceful, curious, responsible, smart, etc., that he has ingested from outside resources to assess who Tom is and what he could potentially bring to the company. Mike would have to think carefully about whether or not Tom matched those prototypical characteristics. It is a slow, thoughtful process for identifying the familiar. The second mental model is the exemplar, which is basically a specific example of a category. Adam Sandler, for example, is an exemplar of a comedian. Mention the name Adam Sandler, and people would categorize him instantly as a comedian. This doesn't mean he's the funniest comedian around, a touchy point in many circles, but instead that he is a specific comedian against whom you can compare others. The same goes for Christmas movies, an exemplar of which would be It's a Wonderful Life. As entrepreneurs gain experience, most start to accumulate concrete examples of a variety of concepts, and over time, they rely more and more on exemplars. Using exemplars speeds up idea processing. After all, entrepreneurs don't have to slow down and recognize the individual, distinctive elements of each and every new idea that's presented to them. Most simply accept that this or that new idea matches an exemplar and is familiar. Let's go back to Tom, our aspiring employee, and imagine that he's being re-interviewed by an experienced entrepreneur, whom we'll call Sally. Sally has worked with numerous people in her career, good and bad, and these colleagues and friends have become, for her, exemplars. Sally would automatically compare Tom to the best or most promising employees she's worked with in the past, and upon deciding that Tom in some ways is familiar to a former star colleague, she quickly offers him a job. One critical facet of pattern recognition is that it allows entrepreneurs to develop an uncanny instinct for opportunity. Research shows that when entrepreneurs have significant prior knowledge, they no longer need to engage in slow, deliberate searches for new ideas. On the contrary, their prior experience gives them a rich library of exemplars they can access automatically. experienced entrepreneurs recognize valuable ideas that are familiar to them based on previous valuable experiences. In short, thanks to exemplars, intentional learning and experience make entrepreneurs far more likely to discover a useful new idea as they can efficiently recognize what is familiar to the exemplar. Earlier, I mentioned serial entrepreneur Kevin Ryan, a successful participant in numerous companies across the tech industry. Kevin has learned to make use of exemplars to find new ideas. He told me how he came up with the idea for Gilt. He said, "On 18th Street in New York, I walked by 200 women waiting in line. I asked one of them why they were all lined up like that, and they told me it was all for a Marc Jacobs sample sale." Kevin was instantly reminded of an exemplar, Vente Privée, a French website that sells discount luxury goods, allowing customers to avoid traveling and waiting for sample sales. Spying the line, he realized this was potentially more than just a European phenomenon. What about the thousands of other potential customers who loved Marc Jacobs but couldn't make it to New York City that day or hated waiting in lines? In short, he observed something familiar to a successful exemplar. Another example is Jared Polis, an American politician and entrepreneur and one of the richest members of Congress. According to financial disclosures, he is worth somewhere between $184 and $591 million. The U.S. government likes to keep things broad. Polis made his fortune as an internet entrepreneur. While attending Princeton, he launched an internet ISP that was later acquired for $23 million. Next, he founded Blue Mountain Greetings, which was acquired during the first internet boom, this time for $760 million in cash and stock. He even started a flower company, ProFlowers.com, which went public and eventually sold for $430 million. As if that weren't enough, he also founded a charter school network and co-founded the high-profile startup accelerator Techstars. Today, though, Jared Polis is mostly known as a quirky congressman. He is a devoted turtleneck wearer and an active video gamer who is currently running for governor of Colorado. We talked on Skype one night about how he used to discover new business ideas. As the research we discussed has shown, the combination of experience and knowledge makes recognizing new ideas more or less automatic. One day, Jared was sending flowers to a friend and was taken aback by the price list. Why were flowers so expensive? He had no experience in agriculture or in the flower business, but he also knew what a good business looked like, not this, and knew many companies, exemplars, that had benefited from moving to a direct-to-consumer model. He trekked around the country, studying the supply chain. He told me, "I visited growers and flower markets. I visited distributors. I talked to tons of industry players." His mission was to understand where during this whole process prices exploded. The result was a completely new model of flower company. ProFlowers sent flowers directly from the grower to the customer. No middlemen or resellers needed. This enabled ProFlowers to deliver fresher flowers for lower prices, creating hundreds of millions of dollars in value, all from an idea that ostensibly appeared in a sudden flash. Experience makes generating familiar ideas easier, but what happens if you don't have experience? Well, there's another way that entrepreneurs can develop exemplars and prototypes. Creative people can also use intentional consumption, see Ted, our video store clerk, to achieve similar results. We don't need direct experience to develop prior knowledge. It turns out observing something can be nearly as good at developing exemplars and prototypes. Studies have found that successful entrepreneurs focus on ingesting third-party material that is specific to the field they work in. One study found that members of a particular entrepreneurship hall of fame were more likely to find inspiration for new business ideas from reading niche trade and industry publications, in contrast to typical entrepreneurs nationwide. Exemplars don't come from consuming just any information. They arise from consuming highly relevant material either within an entrepreneur's field or a field they're considering entering. Through voracious consumption, serial entrepreneurs can develop a set of valuable exemplars even when they switched to new or unfamiliar industries, as Kevin Ryan and Martine Rothblatt both did. These exemplars, in turn, allow them to identify promising new ideas. A new perch. Over the years, and especially today, Ted Sarandos has continued to consume an enormous amount of material. In his case, roughly 3 to 4 hours of film and TV a day. But he does this from a very different perch, a corner office in Beverly Hills. Ted is now the chief content officer of Netflix, where he has overseen its transformation from a DVD rental business to an original programming business that has already won more than 40 Emmys with hit shows like Stranger Things and Orange is the New Black. But let's go back a few years to when Ted dropped out of college to become the general manager of the same video store chain he was working for. This led to an executive role at a video distribution company, and in 2000, he was offered a position at Netflix leading all content acquisition. Looking back, he describes his video store clerking days as film school and MBA course all wrapped up in one. Today, working for a company known for its recommendation algorithm, Sarandos jokes, "I guess I was using an algorithm years before I even knew what an algorithm was." Consumption had driven his ability to understand an audience and create content they cared about. By taking in enormous amounts of material, Ted is today the possessor of a vast library of exemplars. This gives him the ability to process new pitches and ideas efficiently and recognize immediately whether they're original, borrowed, different enough, too different, or somewhere in between. Because of this, Ted and his team have the ability to identify content that hits the ideal spot on the creative curve. It's content that has, as Ted describes it, 1 foot in familiarity and 1 foot in something really fresh, unknown, and novel. A surprising principle. Finding ideas that are familiar to an audience is one of the underpinnings of commercial creativity. From my interviews with today's successful creative artists, I found a surprising pattern. Ted Sarandos' mass consumption of movies and the focused, industry-specific consumption of other leading entrepreneurs weren't flukes at all. No matter whether I was interviewing a painter, a chef, or a songwriter, I'd eventually hear some variation of the same story. Painters show up in numerous art exhibits. Chefs eat at cutting-edge restaurants, visit farms, and travel to food shows. Songwriters are constantly listening to music, new and old. Although these creative artists are typically wildly busy, they consistently spend 3 to 4 hours a day, that is to say roughly 20% of their waking hours, on this type of consumption. This kind of experience allows them to develop the exemplars necessary to know where an idea falls on the creative curve, as if by gut feel. I call this the 20% principle. By spending 20% of your waking hours consuming material in your creative field, you can develop an intuitive, expert-level understanding of the level of familiarity of an idea, where it lies on the creative curve, even without real-world experience. As I explained earlier, studies show us that to master a craft, we invest in countless hours of purposeful practice. The 20% principle is different from that. It won't enable anyone to create the perfect omelet, play the violin, or shoot a basketball. The 20% principle isn't about the physical act or about muscle memory. Rather, it enables us to identify the ideas that are appropriately familiar. We still need to call on the skills to execute those ideas or hire the right people who can, but the 20% principle provides the initial electricity for our light bulb moments. In short, the 20% principle allows you to access the creative curve. In order to create content that is familiar, creative people typically call on an extensive base of knowledge. If you're a writer, it's critical to know what books in your category the audience has read and liked. If you paint for a living, you need to understand whether your latest piece lands on the correct point of the creative curve, or whether it risks coming off as trite, passé, or, alternatively, hopelessly avant-garde. Consumption provides the fuel, but how do you turn that fuel into conscious ideas? Digital mogul. Connor Franta looks like most hip LA 20-somethings. Tight pants, a designery t-shirt, and an omnipresent iPhone. A native of Minnesota, he is someone most people wouldn't look at twice if they passed him on the street. But if he walks by a group of teenage girls, you will hear shrieks, and you might even see one or two faint. Franta is a YouTube celebrity who started posting videos in 2010, when he was only 17 years old. Today, he has more than 5 million subscribers on his page, with each video typically receiving over 500,000 views. He has also written 2 New York Times best-selling memoirs and launched a clothing line, a coffee brand, and a record label with a Sony distribution deal that specializes in pairing emerging musicians with powerful social media influencers. Franta has become a new type of digital mogul, something he credits to his ability to understand his audience. He says, "I know what I like, and I found through the years with YouTube that people like what I like." How did a teenager from Minnesota gain this ability? Again, it started with consumption. He told me, "Before I even made YouTube videos, I was a viewer." He continued, "I watched tons of YouTubers and, in a way, studied them and just understood YouTube before I ever got into it myself." Like Ted Sarandos's, Franta's consumption helped him develop a sense of what is familiar to his audience. He said, "Videos that always gained traction for me were anything I could find that was a relatable topic to anybody, or especially to the majority of my audience. I found that people always wanted me to talk about relationships or anything that was relatable to a teen." The other thing Franta realized was the huge role that novelty played in his success. It wasn't enough to merely understand his audience and what broad types of videos they would relate to. No, he had to offer a novel twist. On his side was timing. Many of the simple, relatable video ideas he came up with were inherently innovative. Back then, YouTube was a new frontier. Franta explained, "There were no rules. I had to set the standard." By consuming lots of videos, he knew what his audience had seen and not seen, which cleared the way for him to create original but recognizable content. Without knowing it, Franta was making use of the creative curve. Among other things, Franta created a series of video lists, for example, 10 Things to Say to a Boy You Like. These videos hit the target for his tween and teenage audience and proceeded to rack up millions of views. Since then, Franta's videos have been copied by thousands of other YouTubers. So, how deliberate and conscious is the process of coming up with ideas? The creative people I talk to, like Connor, were often aware of the mechanics that it took to develop and sharpen their consumer instincts. Nonetheless, they still talked about the resulting aha moments as if they were magical. Like Paul McCartney, Connor Franta described his creative process in terms of sudden inspiration. He said, "Honestly, any idea I get, it just happens. For a YouTube video, if I go to a coffee shop after this, I'll probably get an idea there because I'll see something happening. Or maybe I'll get a clothing design idea because I see some pattern in the sky and I'll literally jot it down. It just happens." His is a consistent experience across multiple fields. One day last year, I traveled to suburban Maryland to meet with Jose Andres, the celebrity chef who, along with his business partner Rob Wilder, owns over 20 high-end restaurants around the world. In addition, they own a fast casual chain, Beefsteak, and a Spanish packaged goods line, and have earned 2 Michelin stars for their food laboratory restaurant hybrid named Minibar. I pulled up in front of an ultra-modern house at 9 a.m. sharp, and was greeted by Andreas's assistant. As I heard the floorboards creak upstairs, I realized I was now guilty of waking up a celebrity chef. Before long, Andres, who has a thick Spanish accent mixed with the fast-talking locution of a kid on a playground, was ushering me into his kitchen. We sat down at his counter and dove right into the topic of creativity. He said, "The beginning of creativity is like the Big Bang. Why did it happen? We still don't know." He looked up. "Anybody want coffee?" He proceeded to take out a food scale, to carefully measure out the perfect amount of espresso. As we got back on task, Andres explained how, like other creators, he absorbs information about his field. He likes to attend chef conferences where he can observe the latest techniques and learn everything he can about new ingredients. To hear him tell it, the inspiration for his recipes also comes in sudden flashes. Says Andres, "I have never liked the salt rim on a margarita. It's usually too much." One day he had an idea. He and his wife were on vacation lying on a beach. He said, "As we were watching the waves crash into the shore, I thought about how light and salty those waves taste on your lips, and it hit me." A longtime user of Sucro, a powdered emulsifier that creates interesting foams for his dishes, he thought suddenly, what if he emulsified salt? No more salt on the rim. Andres went on, just the salty sea foam floating on top of your margarita. In that moment, the now popular salt air margarita was born. Andres, like the other creative people I interviewed, experienced true moments of what felt like mystical flashes of inspiration. But if the creative curve offers a defined blueprint for consumer taste, why do these aha moments occur? Why isn't creativity more of a conscious process? And, more important, can we all learn to create aha moments in our own lives? Being subtle. Imagine you are in a large room. Objects are strewn about, here and there, among them a chair and a table, on which there sits a pole with a hook on one end, a wrench, and an extension cord. On one side of the room, a long cord hangs from the ceiling to the floor. Another cord of the same length is hanging by the opposite wall. No, this isn't a scene from a horror movie. It's the setting of a classic psychology study. The question researchers asked participants was simple, at least on the surface. Can you tie the two cords together? The question is challenging largely because of where the two cords are placed. For example, if a participant grabs one cord and walks it as far as he can in the direction of the other cord, he just can't reach that far. The participants were told they could use any item in the room that would help them, and also any technique that came to mind. Can you figure out a solution? The truth is, there's more than one. If you came up with one or more answers, congratulations. Most people struggle. Now, before patting yourself on the back, I have to break some news. There are four solutions in all. As a participant came up with one solution, one of the researchers would step forward and tell them, now, do it a different way, until they uncovered all four. Here's the first. You tie one cord to a heavy object, maybe the chair, and bring it between the two cords. Now, fetch the other cord and bring it over. Here's the second. You can use the extension cord to lengthen one cord before walking it over to the other cord. Third, you could use the pole to pull over one of the cords while gripping the other. Fourth, you could tie the heavy wrench to one of the cords and turn it into a pendulum by swinging it. Then, as that cord swings back and forth, you could again walk the other cord over. This last solution is the one that intrigued the researchers the most, as involved a kind of transformation. You had to turn the cord into a new object, a pendulum. Of the four solutions, this one was the least intuitive. Only 40% of the study's participants were able to figure out all four solutions without any assistance. If 10 minutes went by and the subjects hadn't yet figured out the fourth solution, the researchers began dropping hints. The first hint was subtle. A researcher would enter the room as if he were simply crossing it and subtly brush the cord so that it started swinging. This hint prompted many of the participants to come up with the last solution. On average, it took them less than a minute after the subtle hint was given for them to come up with the answer. The strange part is that only one student consciously made note of the subtle hint. Even when told later about what the researcher had done, the other students claimed that the brush rope and the subtle swinging had no effect on their discovery. No, most claimed that the solution involving the wrench merely dawned on them in a moment of, well, you might call it inspiration. Even though the participants weren't aware of it, the subtle hint resulted in an aha moment. The two chords experiment shows us two things. First, solutions often show up very suddenly in the guise of aha moments. The second, and more important point, is that even when these sorts of solutions feel like a sudden flash of genius, there's often a reason why we came up with them. They might not have been aware of it, but those students were unconsciously swayed by the subtle swinging of the chord. This has big significance in our exploration of creativity. If scientists can prompt an aha moment in a study subject, is there a way that we can create them in ourselves? The science of aha moments. I want you to take a moment to study these three words. Cream, skate, water. Can you think of a single word that could be put next to all three and still make sense? The answer is ice. Ice cream, ice skate, ice water. If you came up with the solution, how'd you do it? Did it pop into your head instantly, or did you pour through various possible solutions? If you didn't get it at all, what was your approach as you tried to figure it out? These kind of word puzzles tend to fascinate scientists because, depending on the person's experiences, they can be solved either through logical analysis or via aha moments. Logical analysis is straightforward. You ponder whether a word works and think through the puzzle logically, step by step. Aha moments are the flashes of genius we've talked about throughout the book. With these solutions, the answer to the puzzle would come immediately upon seeing it, or after a delay, but without conscious thought. Since these kind of puzzles can be solved using either approach, they give researchers insights into the science of aha moments. Edward Bowden is a researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Bowden, along with a team from Northwestern University's Creative Brain Lab and Drexel University, sought to understand the neuroscience behind aha moments. Were they truly a magical experience, or was there perhaps a biological explanation for them? As part of their study, they tasked subjects to solve various of these word puzzles while connected to an EEG monitor, which can quickly detect the moments when electrical activity takes place in the brain, or an fMRI machine, which, as a reminder, is the machine that can pinpoint where brain activity is taking place by measuring blood flow in the brain. Bowden and his team hoped that by using these two machines, they could see both when and where the brain was activated during aha moments. When connected to the EEG machine, the participants wore goggles that revealed one of the word puzzles and were given 30 seconds to solve it. Once they came up with an answer, they were then asked whether or not the solution came as an aha moment or as the result of logical analysis. 56% of the answers were attributed to an aha moment, 42% to logical analysis, while the remaining 2% checked neither box. On the surface, at least, there seemed to be a minimal difference between these two methods. Regardless of which one was experienced, the solution showed up roughly 10 seconds later. But the EEG readings told a very different story. Electrical brain waves in the gamma band are thought to be activated when our brains engage in perception and language. It's one of the brain waves the scientists were most interested in studying. When participants solve problems via flashes of genius, there was a burst of gamma band activity 0.3 seconds before they came up with an answer. The researchers believe that this burst in electrical activity signals when the solution enters a person's consciousness. It represents the aha. This means aha moments exhibit their own unique brainwave pattern. Have you ever looked at a crossword puzzle question and were unable to come up with a solution? Then, very suddenly, the answer hits you? Well, this feeling of being struck with a sudden solution is reflected by the activity in the gamma bands. So, where exactly did the solution come from? To find out, Bowden and the team of researchers repeated the experiment while monitoring the subjects using an fMRI machine. What they found was that when participants reported aha moments, activity showed up in the right hemisphere of their brains. Not only do flashes of genius have a unique electrical pattern in the brain, they also have their own discrete location. It may be a cliche to talk about the left brain and the right brain, but at the same time, it's critical to our understanding of where creative ideas originate. Generally speaking, the left hemisphere of our brains is where we process the dominant meanings of things. This is where we retrieve straightforward or contextually relevant definitions of words or concepts. When someone asks us what color the sky is, the left hemisphere of our brains shouts out, "Blue!" The left hemisphere is also where logical analysis processing occurs. For example, our left hemisphere is activated when we're asked to solve complex math problems. Why? Because solving for X asks that we bring specific relevant concepts to the forefront of our consciousness before we work through a step-by-step solution. This often feels like a slower process, as we consciously have to work at something. The right hemisphere of our brains is where we store more metaphorical associations. Studies show that our right hemisphere is activated when we hear jokes that, say, rely on puns or when we try to make sense of metaphors. The right hemisphere processes problems by searching for associations between seemingly different concepts with underlying commonalities. This process is subconscious, meaning we're not aware when our right hemisphere is at work, searching for connections. Sometimes it moves quickly. For example, when we hear a stand-up comedian's routine and automatically know why it's funny, or not funny. Other times, our right hemisphere keeps working through a problem subconsciously, discovering a solution only much later. Since the right hemisphere operates below our general level of awareness, when it does come up with an answer, we're seldom aware of the effort it took, which is why we often experience this processing as more automated. As Bowden explains, the right hemisphere is processing language all the time, just like the left is. But what we're saying is that the structure of the two hemispheres is slightly different and that the connections in the left hemisphere are shorter, stronger, and to more direct associations, while the connections in the right hemisphere are longer, weaker, and to more distant associations. If I say worm, you might consciously think fishing and earthworm, a left hemisphere activation. But in the right hemisphere, when I say worm, you might think fishing and earthworms, but also bookworm and gummy worm and even earworm, a song that gets stuck in your head and repeats endlessly. We don't consciously switch between processing in our right and left hemispheres either. Instead, our brains process problems in both hemispheres at the same time. The difference being that, as I mentioned, the processing of our right hemisphere generally operates beneath our level of conscious awareness. We don't even realize our brains are doing what they're doing, which is why all this unseen work ultimately leads to what we think of as aha moments. Researchers believe there are three origins of such aha moments. The first are what I call shower moments. In this scenario, you might already have a solution to something in your brain's right hemisphere, but the activity in the left hemisphere is crowding it out. Once the left hemisphere's logical processing fails to deliver an answer, its activity tends to fade. Once the left hemisphere's activity falls below that of the right hemisphere, the answer from the right hemisphere pops up, as if by magic. Aha! This is why when we wake up, go out for a run, or take a shower, we often experience what feels to us like flashes of genius. Generally, these are occasions when our brains aren't overwhelmed with thoughts, the result being that we experience what seems like sudden inspiration. But if you want to know the truth, it's really just the result of our brains being empty of the crowded chaos of our left brain thinking, which in turn allows long percolating right brain ideas to make their appearance. The second origin of aha moments is through combination. Here, your brain's right hemisphere, knowing that one single concept is unable to give a satisfactory answer, is subconsciously working to connect multiple concepts. If your right hemisphere is able to braid together what feels like a workable solution, it becomes activated. It's this sudden burst of brain activity that creates that flash of genius feeling. As we learned from the two chords experiment, the third origin of aha moments involves a trigger. In this case, an environmental factor subconsciously ignites an association with something already stored in your brain's right hemisphere. For example, if we get stuck working on a crossword puzzle and an hour later walk past the word we were seeking on a billboard, we may well experience a flash of genius without even being aware we saw the missing word. All three of these methods happen below the average human being's conscious level of awareness. Is it any surprise then that these solutions often feel mystical and sent from above by some benevolent deity? In reality, it's not magic, it's biology. Bowden explained that aha moments are simply, quote, a normal cognitive process, but they have a surprising result. Latte art and brain processing. Now, I want you to imagine that you are sitting in a crowded coffee shop with a friend. You're drinking an exquisitely crafted cappuccino. Somehow, the barista sketched a heart into the foam and catching up on life. At the table next to yours, a couple is having an intimate conversation. Even though their table is only a few feet away, you don't really hear what they're saying. Your focus, after all, is on your friend and your cappuccino. All of a sudden, you hear a person at the adjoining table utter your first name. Just as suddenly, you can't help but listen in on their conversation for a few seconds. When you quickly realize that they're talking not about you, but about someone else, you refocus on your friend and your foam heart, and the conversation taking place at the table next to yours fades into the background. One of your brain's core competencies is its ability to filter the world around us for things that are important, things that matter. In neuroscience, important is defined as something that's either potentially harmful or potentially helpful. Your brain is constantly scanning the world around you for this kind of information. When it decides that someone or something will neither harm nor help you, it quickly ignores the stimulus in question. How does our brain do this? Well, it uses both your memories and mental models in a constant assessment of whether someone or something is a potential source of danger or reward. As I wrote earlier, it accomplishes this by gauging how familiar or novel something is. For example, let's go back to that coffee shop. Chances are when you walked in, you didn't consciously notice the chairs. They're just chairs, after all. But what if they were exact replicas of the ones you have in your kitchen? I can almost guarantee that your attention would have been drawn to those chairs. So, how does this process of recognition work? Bowden explains that the sight of a recognizable chair automatically activates an existing memory instead of you having to go through and think, oh, what kind of chair is that? The strength of this activation typically causes it to pop into your consciousness. On the other hand, if you see a chair that deviates from your image of how a chair should look, that is, the prototype, you would notice it as well because your brain would be working hard to decide what in the world you're looking at and whether or not it's safe. Objects that are similar to an exemplar and objects that vary from our stored prototypes cause substantial activity in your brain. This concept of awareness is important because it helps explain why people think that their flashes of insight are magical. Since we are not aware of the work that goes into them, they feel like they take no effort. Another reason they seem supernatural is that people report that many of their greatest ideas originate from, well, aha moments. When discussing their creative processes, they describe how their best ideas come to them seemingly out of nowhere in places like the aforementioned shower. One survey, by a shower company, of course, found that 72% of consumers reported solving problems in the shower. They didn't remember the truly rotten ideas that also accompany their morning shower that their brain subconsciously discarded. All this is to say that most of us tend to correlate aha moments with valuable ideas. I found that many of the creative people I interviewed similarly revered their own aha moments. One evening last year, I traveled to a Greek restaurant in sleepy Malibu to have dinner with Mike Einziger. He's the co-songwriter and guitarist for the band Incubus, one of today's best-selling alternative rock bands, with over 20,000